Hello and welcome to another edition of Running Dialogue, a podcast about movies, and in fact, our final podcast for the year 2010. My name is Kurt Holman, and I write about film for Creative Loafing in Atlanta, and with me are my co-hosts.
Hi, I'm Matt Goldberg with Collider.com.
And I'm Russ Fisher with SlashFilm.com.
And we want to kind of round out the year with some new movies. We want to talk especially about Tron Legacy a bit, and The Fighter, which opened today, True Grit, which opens on the 22nd, and maybe some other things, and maybe we'll do some of our year-end retrospective kind of stuff. But first, who wants to talk about... I mean, I think we all want to talk about Tron to an extent. Who wants to start us talking about Tron?
Okay. And I'll start talking about Tron. Uh-huh. So in the early 80s, Disney made a movie called Tron, mm-hmm. which didn't do very well and kind of got this weird geek cred because it was a very early example of computer-generated imagery. It's about characters that get sucked into a computer mm-hmm. where they have adventures. And it had Jeff Bridges and Bruce Boxleitner and it's not a good movie. Mm-hmm. It really isn't. It's kind of cool looking, and it has stuff in it that's interesting. Like the score is good, and Bridges is fun, and you know they're the light cycle races, you know, and stuff like that.
It has a very interesting design. A lot of visuals kind of age pretty badly to look at it today.
Right.
But it's like, you know, like kind of like just a kind of an artistic design level. There's interesting things.
It's ambitious and it's you know.
And it has its weird charms. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has a giant floating head as its villain.
As its villain. Right,
and
yeah, exactly.
Jeff Bridges is charismatic and charming as mm-hmm. a lead.
And so now we've got Tron Legacy, mm-hmm. which is basically the same movie mm-hmm. with more expensive stuff. Yeah. And but I mean, a lot of the same flaws. It's mm-hmm. it's about so essentially, Jeff Bridges' character from the original Tron has disappeared. His son, played by Garrett Hedlund, is grown up to be kind of a jerk mm-hmm. and reckless and headstrong. And he's like, sort of, you know, there's a big computer company called Encom, of which his father was an instrumental part. And since his father's disappearance, Sam, the Garrett Hedlund character, is sort of flirting with having some involvement with the company, but really just likes to prank them more than anything else.
They establish that he's like the principal shareholder of the company, but he also like hacks and messes with the company, not unlike the way his father did as a former employee of Encom back in the beginning of the first film.
Although in the first film, it makes sense that his father was fired, his ideas were stolen, so it makes sense for him to hack Encom. As a majority shareholder who could do pretty much what he wanted, it makes no sense for Garrett to break into his own company.
But see, you just said something really important right there. You said makes no sense, which implies that Tron Legacy tries to make sense. And, I mean, it's disingenuous probably to say that no thought was put into the movie. But it's, I think, very accurate to say that there's very little evidence of thought being put into the movie as you watch it. You're talking about Sam Flynn pranking the company, mm-hmm. and the movie opens with the launch of this kind of Windows-esque mm-hmm. operating system, the new, you know, Encom 12. It's their new OS, and there's a joke at the beginning where somebody's asking, you know, the guy who's the chairman of the board is like, well, you know, what's different about this one? What's, you know, what new stuff? Well, the Bruce Boxleitner character asked him this, who also returns from Tron. You know, what's new in this? What did you do here? It's like, and he kind of deadpan jokes like, well, we put a 12 on the box.
Yeah, we changed the name to 12.
Maniacal, evil business corporate guy laughter. But that's exactly what Tron Legacy is.
Yeah.
It's Tron with a new thing on the box. That's it. And I can't believe that they made that joke in the beginning of the movie, because it applies so well to Tron Legacy in general. So basically, Sam gets sucked in the computer and
basically goes through the same, pretty much the same exact set pieces as his father's character did from the first one.
Exactly.
Only with better special effects.
Right, you know? Right. He ends up looking for his father. He finds him. He finds this other character named Cora, who's played by Olivia Wilde, who's really the human standout in the film. She's the actor with the most sort of lifelike energy and it's certainly the most entertaining to watch.
And they make sure that she gets almost no screen time as soon as she begins to come alive.
Exactly.
They literally shut her down.
No, it's true. Yeah. And then it's just the same. It's Tron again, but with with, like you said, better effects, mm-hmm. bigger stuff. There's a great score by the French electronic duo Daft Punk, who make a sort of entertaining little cameo in the movie. I find myself with very little to actually say about it, because it's just the as each day goes by after I've seen it, I saw it on Tuesday night, I just forget more and more about it. It's very empty and very...
I think Matt and I have quite a few things to say about it.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, there's less, you know, there's not a lot of thought put into it. I mean, it's sort of like it is, in a weird way, you know, Tron with a number on the box, and yet it seems less thought went into this version in terms of world building. It's all form and no function. You know, one of the things in the original Tron is these programs, NCOM programs, are getting gobbled up by the Master Control program, and if the MCP has no use for them, they get thrown into arena-style games.
Right.
But we see that each we're told that programs are sort of made in the image of their users, that sort of God-man idea. And so it's sort of amusing. You see, like, this, like, nerdy accounting program who's, like, overweight. It's like, you're going into the game.
But I'm an accounting programmer.
I know. And it's, like, it's modeled off the guy who would use it. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of amusing and kind of charming. And you get, like, a brief glimpse of that when Sam first goes into the grid. Mm-hmm. And then nothing at all. Everyone's supermodels, and it's like there's no thought put into this world other than needs more neon.
Yeah. That's what's the really, frankly, shocking thing about the movie to me is that, you know, when the first Tron came out, computers were like this niche thing. I mean, the personal computer was like had just come out, you know, like I think the Lucy or whatever had just come out. You know, now like everyone, not everyone, but, you know, most people spend a good part of their lives on computers in cyberspace, working, playing, interacting, you know.
Right.
There's so much
potential.
So many possible metaphors they could use with Tron for the way we live now.
And there's none of it.
And still be an action movie and all that.
Sure.
And there's nothing. I mean, there's less about computer-human interaction in this movie than there was in the first one, you know?
So. And there's not a lot of understanding of this world. It's like no research was done into the words they use. There's a lot of jargon, and it's really embarrassingly used, like open source. You know,
it feels like somebody combed Wikipedia and pulled out a bunch
pretty
of
much.
Words
it's like listening
sprinkled them into the script.
It's like you're listening to a technophobe or a Luddite, you know, try to talk to you about technology, and he's like, "I read this in Time." Right? It's like, did you understand it? No, but I read it in Time.
And that kind of gets back to what I was saying too about this being Tron with a new number on the box, is because there's shockingly little imagination in the world. I mean, it's like almost everything that we see in this film is just an updated version of something that was in the original movie. Mm-hmm. You know, there's very, very little that's in here. And like you said, it's like we've got decades of computer development. Mm-hmm. We've got decades of increasing computer awareness on the part of users. All sorts of things that could be done, and there's just none of it. Mm-hmm. It's like, let's take the same vehicles and make them more stylized. Mm. Let's take the same locations and make them more stylized. You know, and like you said, Matt, strip away. Yeah, I mean, you see these programs, these characters, and wait, what function do they have in the computer again? What do they do here? What is Michael Sheen's weird nightclub, like, kind of David Bowie by way of Casablanca character doing in this society?
There's this weird character named Jem, played by Bo Garrett, and we first see her when Sam enters the arena, and she and these other weird programs, they strip off his clothes and put him in the armor and whatever. And then, like, she, like, locks herself into a wall.
Right.
And I thought that'd be the end of her character. I'm like, oh, okay, so that's her job as a program, dressed, combatant.
Perfect. Yeah. Great.
And then it seems – but then later on, you see her walking around. It's like, so
that's her job.
That's literally her job. She's like, what a terrible job. It's like, I'm going to go back and to be locked into a wall. And what's even
– But I only have to do it for 8 hours a day because then I can go to Michael Sheen's nightclub afterwards.
I can leave
and
the
I can
wall.
Take my little parasol with me, even though there's no sun and no rain and no reason for me to have a parasol other than it makes me look cool. And that to me is Tron Legacy in a nutshell, because it looks cool.
And it doesn't even look that cool.
It wears thin.
Because there's nothing else in it. So, you know, 2 hours plus of this, it's like, I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Fine. Thank you. Would you give me something else to pay attention to now?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, two other things about the story. One of it is that, you know, it's like, okay, it's not about really computer metaphors. What is it about? And it kind of hinges on these things that are called isometric algorithms or ISOs. And they're like programs, but they're not made by people. So they're like aliens or angels. They're
kind of spontaneous AIs.
Yeah. And the bad guy, who we'll get to in a minute, like basically wants to wipe them all out. And so there's
for a reason that's not really well explained. I never understood why he wants.
There's this genocidal aspect of it, and almost like a Holocaust thing.
I was actually kind of offended by that. Uh-huh. You know, it's like you're sort of like, and it's weird. It takes a lot to offend me, and and I wasn't incensed and up in arms about it. But as we're watching this movie, and they're just sort of, very liberally and loosely throwing around this idea of genocide that happened, but there's no weight to it. There's no evidence. It's like, really? You're just going to kind of throw out like the Tron Holocaust and just have it be a weird little...
Yeah. Exactly. And it's like, of all the stories this movie could be about, that's the weird thing is the one... It's like, well, okay. the other thing is that... there's an idea that it has that's kind of interesting or potentially interesting in the fact that the villain is also played by Jeff Bridges and is a program written by Jeff Bridges who thus looks like him and has gone bad. And they have this kind of Frankenstein thing with, like, the creator and his creation having a rivalry. And they almost allude to, like, a sibling rivalry.
Are we talking about The Social Network again?
No. Well, are we? You know, it's a social...
No, we're not.
Yeah. Between Clue, who's the bad program, and Sam, who's the son, it's like the creation and the son, it's like they're both sons, you know. They don't really do a whole lot with that, but it's like, it's kind of this interesting idea that's kind of out there and... they don't really pick up on.
Right. Well, I read an interesting, a really interesting take on the film by this writer, Silas Lesnick, who writes for ComingSoon.net. He wrote for Crave Online this interesting editorial about how it's a Hamlet allegory. And so Clue Kevin Flynn both represent a father figure that Sam. And it's actually a really well-written article. I encourage people to check it out. But it's interesting sort of like how you approached it as it's like two sons, you know, two creations. And then you could also see it as two fathers. But I think... the thing is like neither one has enough evidence really to really push it forward. And it's almost like the film is all subtext because there's very little text.
Yeah. But I mean, I like the idea of that. And partly it's because I think Jeff Bridges is like kind of trying to have fun with the two roles. Mm-hmm. But the dialogue for his like AG and Kevin Flynn character is really kind of spacey, and they make fun of it as being kind of like almost Jeff Lebowski-ish dialogue. Right. But it, like what he's actually talking about is hard to make sense, you know.
He has all this kind of dialogue about Zen and being, and it's like
weren't you from the 80s?
Digital
like,
jazz,
why are you? It's
man.
Like why are you using you know slang from the 60s and 70s if you're an 80s? You're supposed to be an 80s guy,
right?
You know, what shouldn't you be like throwing out like tubular? Radical.
Yeah. And the clue, the visual effect to make him look young just looks weird and not a way. And you feel like he's supposed to look real and he doesn't look real. So
I was able to buy that because he's a digital creation. Yeah. He's a digital copy. You know, there could have been a little bit more in the story and in the dialogue to support the fact that, hey, yeah, this effect isn't that great, but we meant it like that.
Yeah.
That's what the story is supposed to
be. I didn't even work with that because he looks exactly like young Kevin Flynn. They try to digitally de-age the real Kevin
When you see
Flynn.
The real Kevin Flynn
right.
is young.
He also looks creepy and things.
Yeah.
So for me, the effect never came together. Mm-hmm. It's like we attempted something and the technology wasn't there.
Yeah.
We got as close as we could with the tools and the money and the time that we had. Here's what it is. It doesn't work. I admire the attempt. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it'll be there one day, but for this, it was just incredibly distracting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will say that
There's a digitally de-aged Bruce Boxleitner as well.
Yeah, and
of whom you see very little.
Very little. It's like, okay, one bad de-aging effect is enough. Let's just try to mask this up.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, like, from like the point when they like first beam him onto the grid to the point where he met the real Kevin Flynn, I really enjoyed it. I mean, looks cool. It's exciting. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then it's like it basically felt – I didn't really like the part before that. And the part after that felt like the Matrix sequels to me, you know. So it was like, oh, well.
The energy in this movie peaks really, really early.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting
and
it.
Then
yeah.
there's, and then it tries to – I mean, basically the end of the first act is the peak of the energy in Tron Legacy. And there's a couple points where they, you know, they try to throw in some, you know, there are a couple other action scenes. But, like, there's that whole weird thing that takes place in Michael Sheen's nightclub. that I just was just silly and pointless to me.
Michael Sheen at least is having fun, and I give him credit for that. But his character is so briefly seen, it's like he doesn't matter. And it's just this underdeveloped idea to sort of throw – first off, it's bad for the story because what it does is – it throws our characters apart. Mm-hmm. Sam goes to the nightclub on his own, leaving Cora and Kevin behind. So now they're separated again. Mm-hmm. So now we're not taking a journey with all these characters. Right. We're cutting out Cora, who's probably the most interesting character.
Right.
And it's just bad pacing. And that pacing carries throughout. You know, you get, you know, they're on the run. And then, and this is another mistake that the original film makes. Mm-hmm. They hop on a solar sailor and talk. Just hopping on a solar sailor for some heart to heart. And like it just seriously on rails. Nothing's happening. Nothing is happening to them, really.
It worked in Unstoppable.
I did like the part where they talked about his motorcycle. You know, there's a part where like the father, it's like this night, it's like kind of the father son bonding moment that it's like, well, this is kind of like where I think they want to go with this, but I don't think the rest of it really worked on that.
I'm pretty sure that a bunch of the conversations that take place on the train, mm-hmm. which actually were some of the few parts of the film that I liked, mm-hmm. Because they were the only places where character actually came into it, you know, and you had some real interaction between Bridges and Hedlund, and that was not great, but not bad. And my understanding is that that's part of the stuff that was reshot that had some Pixar influence where they kind of took the movie to Pixar and were like, hey, yeah, this doesn't work. Help us.
Right. And to me, that stuff didn't work, not because I like the attempt, but it's shoehorned in there so awkwardly that it felt like, you know, it might as well just be a digital effect you're cleaning up as it didn't really come about organically. Like the film just stops to have this conversation that hasn't really grown out of anything. You know, you don't really even feel a lot of distance that would most likely be between a son whose dad just disappeared on him without any explanation. It's sort of like, hey, Dad, let's, you know, there's a little tension, but nothing a heart-to-heart can't really heal.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, there's – I guess I was just willing to buy that sequence because it's like – the movie comes to a stop in terms of the forward momentum, but at the same time, there is stuff going on there. You know, it's one of the few places the characters actually make an attempt to genuinely interact. And I guess I responded to that more than...
Yeah, to me, it was more like a shifting down into a lower gear. And I was like, well, I'm okay for like the pace to slow down a little bit for a while.
Right.
Or would have been if I'd like the rest of the movie more, you know.
Right. But, if it had been really intense and action-filled, like, up until that point, like, I would have appreciated the breather.
Right.
The problem is it was meandering already up to that point.
Oh, yeah.
So the pacing of it is just even more awkward. You're not slowing down. You're just sort of, I'm going to shamble, and now I'm going to amble, you know. I'm going to one thing that's delaying the action and the intensity, and I'm going to go to something else that, you know, at least it has character development, but isn't much better.
Right.
I'm going to get a T-shirt with that shamble, amble thing.
Trademark.
Well, should we move on to The Fighter then?
Let's move on to good movies.
Yes. Yes. Okay, I'll talk about The Fighter.
Talk about The Fighter.
All right. So Fighter is based on this real-life boxers, Mickey Ward and Dickie Eklund. Dickie Eklund sort of had his shot at the title, and in the film he's played by Christian Bale. And he's sort of this hero of Lowell, Massachusetts, the self-proclaimed pride of Lowell.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like, I knocked down Sugar Ray Leonard. He didn't beat him. And
he just knocked him down.
He knocked him down. Yeah. And then Dickie blew it all on becoming a crackhead. But Mickey is more responsible, might have his shot. Unfortunately, he's seen as a stepping stone. In the film, Mickey is played by Mark Wahlberg. Mm-hmm. And so Dickie's his trainer.
My stepping stone.
I'm sorry. Yeah, stepping stone in that he's a boxer you can beat on your way to a real title. He's not someone you need to be concerned about. He's, you know, he's there. He's a punching bag pretty much. And, you know, so Dickie's his trainer. His mom, played by Melissa Leo, is his manager. And but everyone seems to like Dickie a lot more. Mm-hmm. They also have this amazing family of like these big haired sisters. They're the only two boys. But there's like seven angry sisters.
They're like a Greek chorus of harpies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's amazing.
It's like this army of high haired, chain smoking women who yell things like bar skank. And they never seem to have anything to do. They're always just sort of hanging around and it's like, and ready to get in the face of other people who they disagree with.
Yeah.
And it's very, very funny.
It is. Yeah. It's, the film is really funny. It has a lot of sharp dialogue, and but it also has a lot of weight to it because, you know, the film is about Mickey, you know, family is sort of held up as this thing, you know, like it's what you rely on, and it's what you depend on. Mm-hmm. And it makes this nice subversive jab. It's like sometimes it can be what's holding you back. Mm-hmm. And it's not that everyone in your family is bad, because Mickey's get support from his father mm-hmm. and from family friend and from a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of this idea that sometimes family may mean well, but they can absolutely destroy you. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of the – it's a boxing drama where the boxing is very well done, mm-hmm. very impactful. You really feel the hits. Mm-hmm. It's well shot. It's shot, I think, on video, like in the
– it looks like it was shot on video.
Well, the box – the actual matches, yeah, they're shot to look like –
like old
early 90s HBO presentations, right. You know. And there's that thread that runs through the whole movie, because the real Dickie Eklund actually, when the film opens, Dickie is being filmed by a camera crew, and he's telling everybody that he's the film is about his comeback. But really, it's an HBO documentary about crack addiction, mm-hmm. and it's the film in the film is based on a real documentary mm-hmm. called High on Crack Street, mm-hmm. Lost Lives in Lowell, which is an incredible piece of work mm-hmm. that did air on HBO in the early 90s, in which you see Dickie kind of in this crack house that's replicated in the film. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The fighter, it's astoundingly light on its feet. It's mm-hmm. really, you know, like you said, it's full of humor. And the interesting thing is it's all – so much of that humor is Christian Bale, mm-hmm. who's not known for being a particularly effervescent actor.
It's one of those revelatory performances.
It really is.
It's like, this is Christian Bale.
I had kind of given up on the guy. I'm like, oh, he's just going to do grim and gritty.
He's angry, phenomenal.
It's transformative.
He's so good.
He's funny. He's sad. Yeah. He's hurt. You know, he wants, you know, but he's also effervescent.
Yeah.
And it's an astounding performance that maybe just do a 180.
Yeah, when you first see him, it's like, that's Christian Bale. And he's like talking a mile a minute, and his eyes are practically popping, you know. And there's like, he's been playing like, you know, these sort of stern, tortured enforcers of authority for years. And now he's like, totally cut loose, you know. Yeah,
and it's magnificent. It's wonderful to watch. And yeah, he's playing. Yeah, he's the opposite of the image he's cultivated for himself. Mm-hmm. And it's great. It's so much.
But it's
fun.
Great to see it sort of in the context of a drama. Like normally, if you know when. Actors sort of trying to expand, they go something polar opposite. So, you know, you'd see Christian Bale in like a madcap comedy, you know? And instead, like, this is still a drama, you know? I mean, but even though it's very, very funny, but it's amazing, like, sort of how he works that in and does find the humor and the life in this role, but also, you know, the dramatic impact of Dickie Eklund.
Yeah. I don't really think of Mark Wahlberg as being the most like versatile actor out there. This might be a bold statement on my part, but
we can back you up.
Yeah, but he's very well cast in this because his character is like nice puppy dog of a guy who's completely conflict averse when it comes to his family, even though he wants to like go into boxing rings and beat people up, you know. Mm-hmm. So he has to be practically forced into confronting his family when he hooks up with Amy Adams, who becomes his girlfriend, you know. So it's like
– it's sort of his de facto manager in the sense of being like, you know what? Maybe all of these decisions – or maybe all these decisions that have been made for you were not mm-hmm. the best ones.
Yeah, right.
And it might be time to rethink.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the thing I really like about his performance is it's – you know, with hell. It doesn't, you know, it's a Lee performance. And I think, you know, there could easily be an instinct like, I have to compete now mm-hmm. for, you know, I have to compete with, you know, not only Christian Bale, but Melissa Leo, who also does an outstanding job.
Amy Adams.
I have to, like, compete. And instead, Wahlberg understands a cast dynamic. Mm-hmm. And he understands where his character fits and the kind of person that he would have to – that Mickey is to fit into this dynamic is someone who was probably talked over his whole life, mm-hmm. probably put into a corner and probably pushed around, but sort of, you know, nudged in mm-hmm. a particular directions. And to sort of have that quiet performance, I think, is really to Wahlberg's credit. It's thoughtful because mm-hmm. it understands, no, I'm part of a cast here. I'm not sort of trying to compete. And I think that's really admirable.
And it's worth noting, too, that the film is directed by David O. Russell, who's mm-hmm. directed probably the only two other previous compelling Mark Wahlberg appearances.
Well, I would
also, Huckabee's in Three Kings.
I'd also add The Departed to that.
Oh, well, in The Departed as well. Absolutely. Yeah, no, he's fantastic in that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so Russell and Wahlberg obviously have a working relationship that you know, really delivers. And so that's got to be a big part of this. And he... Yeah, Russell manages everything really well. I mean, he manages the tone of the movie. He manages – it's a heavy movie. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on because of, you know, Melissa Leo playing the mother of both Mickey and Dickie is you know, she's kind of – she's not overbearing, but she's possibly over-concerned, and she really thinks that she knows the right thing. She thinks that she's got the best possible – she has the best intentions, but she thinks that that's enough, and and she's very, very resistant to the idea of anything changing the dynamic that they've had set up. And Leo is fantastic. I mean, she's great. She joins this sort of interesting 2010 pantheon of – you know, basically, like, I don't know. I keep joking about Mom Off.
Yeah.
I keep joking about Mom Off 2010 because you've got Jackie Weaver in Animal Kingdom. Yeah. You got Melissa Leo in The Fighter. You've got Barbara Hershey in Black Swan.
You've got Annette Bening
and Kids Are All Right. You've got, I mean, it's like there's all in an industry that's said to have no good roles for women over 40, 2010 is packed with them, you know, each actress in her own way really does a lot of amazing work. And Melissa Leo is just the latest example of that. She does really beautiful stuff with this character in The Fighter. And you have sympathy for her. You don't really want her to get what she wants, but you can understand where she's coming from. And you don't, you can't really hate her. You can't write her off. And so she, you know, Leo walks this really tricky line of
it's kind of
ugly, emotionally ugly character, interesting and bearable and sympathetic.
Right. No, it's a wonderful, wonderful performance. And, you know, but the entire cast is just outstanding. It's really a great ensemble piece where, you know, you do have like the bigger performances like Leo and Bale, but they all work together to understand a dynamic. It's a family film where, you know, actors really aren't trying to outshine each other as much as they're trying to click together to create a real and compelling portrait of this, you know, family from this working class family that wants a shot at the big time through their son.
Yeah. I was going to say, I believe the Vulture blog did a comparison of like the bad mothers of like the current films of the season.
Yeah.
And it mentioned Nicole Kidman in Rabbit Hole, who plays the mother of a child who died. And she, and they're just like, we're not saying that she's a bad mother. We're just saying that her child is dead. maybe on that note, we should shift over to True Grit.
Speaking of deceased parents.
I will do True Grit. True Grit is the Coen brothers' remake of the 1969 John Wayne movie, which was based on a novel by Charles Portis. And in some ways, it's very much more faithful to the book than the John Wayne film was. In some ways, the both movies are similarly faithful in that there are parts where, like, the dialogue in both movies is, like, word for word from the book. Mm-hmm. So it's funny. After I saw the remake, I watched the trailer of the John Wayne movie because I don't remember the John Wayne movie back that well. And some of the scenes, it's like, these are the same.
They're the same.
So
the climactic, you know, fill your hands, you son of a bitch.
Things like the young girl named Maddie Ross, like folding the cigarette for Rooster Cogburn, played by Jeff Bridges, and the Texas Marshall character, played by Glenn Campbell in the first one, and Matt Damon here saying, you know, I'll steal a kiss from you, and she was objecting. Like the lines are the same, you know.
Right.
So, but. Not to get ahead of myself, Haley Steinfeld plays a 14-year-old girl named Maddie Ross, whose father is killed in a town, like, away from home by basically a hired hand who turned out to be pretty much of a shitheel. And Maddie Ross goes to the town to retrieve her father's body and kind of goes off the reservation and wants to hire a U.S. Marshal to track down the guy and bring him to justice. And there's a funny part that's, again, from the book where she asked the local sheriff, you know, like, who should I get to hire, you know, who should I hire to go get the guy? And the sheriff says, like, you know, well, the best tracker is probably this guy. The meanest is Rooster Cogburn. And, but probably the best guy is this other guy. And he talks about the other guy for a bit. And she says, where can I find Mr. Cogburn? You know?
Right.
So she wants, you know, he wants someone with a true grit. And he wants someone who's a killer.
Yeah.
You know? So, and Jeff Bridges plays the John Wayne role as Rooster Cogburn, who is this, you know, drunken, aging, fat, you know, bounty hunter, U.S. Marshal, who's even kind of more seedy and a wreck than the John Wayne one was. And mm-hmm. Bridges speaks with this voice that's practically a gargle, you know, and it's kind of wonderful just to listen to.
Sounds like his throat's been cut.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so, and she, Hayley Steinfeld, is very funny at playing Maddie Ross as just this young girl who just will not take no for an answer and cannot argue pretty much anybody. And he hires her, you know, she insists on going with him. She can't stop Rooster Cogburn from throwing in with this U.S. Marshal, Texas Ranger, thank you, played by Matt Damon, who's searching for the same guy. And they basically go into the territories, you know, not a state, but, you know, where the U.S. law has no jurisdiction to find the outlaw played by Josh Brolin. So what y'all think?
I loved it to death. Mm-hmm. It has some of the best introductions of mm-hmm. characters I've seen in a while. Like, you know, the way it introduces Hayley Steinfeld as Maddie mm-hmm. Ross, she has just this amazing scene where she's haggling over the price of horses, and she just owns it. And this is, like, basically introducing her.
Yeah, I think it's her first feature.
Right, and she's outstanding. Role. I was just blown away by mm-hmm. how good she is. Mm-hmm. And then, we're kind of introduced to Rooster as he's like on the, you know, in an outhouse, but we first really see him in a courtroom and it's amazing. Just him just sort of like trying to say how he basically went and killed these two guys on the stand. Yeah. He's like, I don't recall. Yeah. It's like, the lawyer's trying to lead him and to the point where it's like the simple question and Bridges just repeats it back. And then Matt Damon, you know, he's sort of kind of a little creepy, but also, you know, in a weird, he plays it kind of as a harmless nincompoop. I mean, he's called a nincompoop at one point. I'm like, that is a perfect word to describe him. But he's not like the worst guy ever.
Yeah.
But he has a great sort of tête-à-tête with, you know, with Steinfeld in their first encounter. Mm-hmm. And I just love the dialogue. Now, I haven't read the book and I haven't seen the original, and so I don't know how much of it mirrors. But the dialogue for me just crackled.
It's
the way it was delivered.
It's very archaic sounding. It's kind of like the "Oh brother, where art thou" dialogue, only more so. It almost sounds like Shakespeare in a weird way. Because it's very oddly formal.
I was going to say, it reminded me, the film reminds me a great deal of my favorite Coen Brothers film, mm-hmm. Miller's Crossing, mm-hmm. because they both have this really generous approach to dialogue. I mean, they just, that scene with Rooster Cogburn on the stand in the trial is a great example where, I mean, you could cut that scene down to a third of its length and you still get the same stuff across, but the movie just kind of puts him up there and just gives everybody involved a whole lot of great dialogue to deal with, and it's just like, go do it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, in a lot of ways, it's like the True Grit and The Fighter are similar films to me also in that they're pretty simple stories. They're the filmmaking is pretty undorned, and it's all about taking a dense, meaty script, giving it to a great cast, and just being like, go to town, you know, do this. And True Grit just, I mean, it's, and you know, that's not to undermine Roger Deakins' cinematography, because it's absolutely gorgeous. Carter Burwell's score, which also, I mean, there are specific instances in the score that reminded me of Miller's Crossing, which he also scored. True Grit just works beautifully as this actor's piece. I've seen people kind of poo-pooing it a little bit in the sense that it seems, saying, oh, this seems kind of unambitious for the Coens and whatever, but
totally disagree.
And I completely disagree with that, but it's them working in a maybe a bit more classic mode than we're used to seeing from them. It's like they let it go and they don't get in the way, but they keep it crystalline, they keep it very, very clear, and it's just absolutely beautiful to watch.
I still think you see their fingerprints on it. I mean, not only the people that they hire, both in terms of the cast and behind the camera, but as well as just that dark sense of humor. And it is slightly offbeat in its own weird way, but it feels like we're just going to go and create one of the best Westerns ever. How about that? How do you feel about that, Joel? Sounds great, Ethan. Let's go do that. Okay. And they did.
I don't know. I don't have a I don't know if I can back up this argument very well, but I felt kind of like what you describe other people as feeling, where it was like, you know, true grit, wry, compelling, Western, good across the board, but not a classic, and I almost kind of expect something that's a classic or something surprising from them. Hmm. And it's like, well, this is pretty much exactly what I expected, you know, both, and partly it's because, you know, I know the story and the material, and it didn't really throw many curves at me.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, well, I mean, I certainly appreciate this better than the other movie, but it didn't seem radically different than the other movie, too. But what, the thing that I think that I felt where they were most interested, apart from obviously liking their actors so much, was in conveying kind of the harshness and the weirdness of the West. There's lots of very kind of strange, kind of grotesque-looking figures. And there's, like, American Indian characters are treated very kind of badly in the margins. Mm-hmm. They, like, go to a trading post, and there's these two Native American kids, you know, on the porch. And Richard Coburn just kind of gratuitously, like, kicks them off the porch for no reason.
Well, no, he kicks them off the porch because they were abusing a horse.
But were they doing
they're beating it, they're treating it like crap, and he like cuts the mule.
Well, he stopped them, but and then they like get back, and then he comes back out and kicks them off the porch again, you know. And a scene
probably would have done the same thing.
Yeah, the scene, I think a better example you're talking about is like when they're about to hang three people, and the two white guys sort of get their last words, and the Native American guy before he can even talk, they just put the hood over his head. That destroyed me.
There's a scene that I kind of wonder might be one of their favorites, which is when they're kind of out in the woods, in the wilderness, and this guy, this apparition comes out, and it's this guy dressed in a bear skin, and he looks like half human at first, because like the bear head is over his own head. Yeah,
it looks like a bear riding a horse.
Yeah.
That shot's in the trailer, too, so you can see it there. But
Basically says, you know, y'all need any doctoring? Because he's supposed to be a doctor, you know? Yeah. And so like this half-human thing is, like, actually, like, a source of civilization or what passes for that out in where they are, you know? And they're like, no thanks, you know? But so I liked that. The rest of it, I was like, well, I was oddly unmoved by it, I guess, you know? So I'm not sure how to account for that, you know?
Yeah. I guess I was moved by it in the same, the same way I was The Fighter. I mean, The Fighter is this real-life Rocky story, and it's rousing. And, I mean, by the end, the last fight in that, I was just completely so with the movie, so ready to jump out of my seat, you know, didn't know how it was going to end. And, and True Grit, I know how it's going to end, you know, but still just the way it's put together, you know, when you get to sort of this climactic showdown scene, such as it is, and it's, you know, very similar to the one in the original film. I was just right there with it, and it just felt like exactly what it needed to be. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these things have come to a certain point. The actors have been perfect. And I wanted to see it play out, and I loved watching it play out. Yeah. And the Coen brothers are known for being surprising. I mean, their films are, they're some of the most, as far as people working in sort of mainstream American cinema, they're among the most surprising directors.
And yet consistent.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. With very few blips. I mean, but this is not a surprising movie, but to me it was a deeply satisfying one. And I couldn't have enjoyed it more.
Right. I didn't really go. I went in not really knowing what to expect other than I love the Coen brothers. So, you know, what do you want to throw at me? And I was just absolutely swept up in it because everything is just at the top of its game.
Yeah.
Everything is just so well put together and just constructed. And the dialogue, it just had me howling with laughter. Mm-hmm. But also I was very, you know, I thought the characters were thoughtful and layered. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it all came together so perfectly. Mm-hmm. And it's a film I just want to go back and just, you know, it feels like something I'm going to quote, like quoting Miller's Crossing, you know, or all their films, you know, just filled with that great dialogue delivered by fantastic actors. Yeah. So I loved it to death.
One little side detail is that the score frequently draws on a hymn called Leaning on the Everlasting Arms, which is a song that's very prevalent in the movie Night of the Hunter, they use on. So I was actually thinking about Night of the Hunter all the way through it because it's like, oh, it's leaning on, you know. So and there's, I believe, Hunter's out on DVD or Blu-ray.
Came out on Criterion.
Recently. So anyway. But, well, okay, well, should we do some of our year-end retrospective? action stuff while we kind of wind out, you know.
Sure.
So, what were y'all's, I mean, y'all might not have your list yet, but y'all have like your favorite films of the year or some of them?
I mean, yeah, I don't have, there are a couple of things I haven't seen yet, but I just watched Exit Through the Gift Shop again. Mm-hmm. It's streaming on Netflix now. And available on DVD. Mm-hmm. And I still think it's a wonderful movie, and I still think it's a surprising, interesting, unusual one that presents this kind of core mystery. You know, to quickly recap Exit mm-hmm. Through the Gift Shop, it's the street artist Banksy supposedly having a documentary made about him by this guy named Terry Guetta, who becomes an artist named who calls himself Mr. Brainwash. And supposedly halfway through, Banksy kind of takes over the movie and starts, instead of it being a movie about him, it's a movie about Terry Guetta. And it's just a wonderful piece of work on consumption of art and how art is made for audiences and what it all means. And it's kind of a mystery in that you don't really know which parts of it are real and which parts of it are not.
Mm-hmm. And it's also very funny and it's very smart.
It's lively and hilarious, and I love it.
Yeah, and it does a good job of actually kind of showing the recent history of, like, outsider art and, mm-hmm. like, you know, graffiti art and things like that, you know. Right.
Which raises, like, I think one of the most interesting questions in the film is, like, if art is done sort of outside the confines of a museum, like, who owns it? Mm-hmm. Who takes ownership of art? And it's just it's a mystery inside of, you know, fascinating questions on the philosophy mm-hmm. of the nature of art. I mean, that's like, and just in this, but yet in a fun, lively documentary that isn't trying to, you know, and now we begin a dissection in art history 503.
Right.
No, it's just very lively and incredibly entertaining. Mm.
Yeah, so that's it's probably my favorite film of the year, and the film I kind of listed in my second favorite film in a list I did recently was Catfish, the documentary, and which I think people has actually suffered in some people's estimation because there have been all these other documentaries with questionable veracity, and mm-hmm. people have questioned the veracity of Catfish, even though the filmmakers say, well, pretty much everything is real, you know, but some people are, like, skeptical. But it's the one where these two guys are filming one of their guy's brother, and he gets involved with this family through the internet and Facebook and gradually finds out that they're not what they seem, and, you know, it becomes kind of a mystery story. And then this kind of actually oddly touching, genuine relationship story kind of develops by the end of it. And I thought it was just a kind of a mystery and a commentary about how social networks work and can be abused, you know. Mm-hmm. It just caught me up like practically nothing else I'd seen this year. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to be, and also I kind of liked this movie. It's like, if you have like teenagers and want to show them, it's like, you know, okay, here's the warning against like social networks and the internet, because people might mess with you like this, you know.
Right.
So, but and I feel like it has not gotten the due that it deserves at the end of this year.
Yeah, I don't understand people writing. It's like I don't think it's actually real, and it's like, to me, that is missing the point. It's, I think people are so determined, like, I don't want to be fooled, you know, because if I'm fooled, then that reflects poorly on me as an individual. It's like, it's not about you.
Yeah.
Take the film on its own. I mean, trust what it says. If it turned out to be fake, okay, then that'll change your perspective of it. But I think on its own, it still stands as an interesting question of, if we were to take this at face value, what would it mean and what does it say about our culture? And I think that is a perfectly interesting question on its own. If you're like, now I can't get into it because it might have been staged, okay, well, does that now change the entire meaning of the film, or does that in some way make it a meta commentary?
Yeah.
It's like, I can't trust people on the internet and I can't trust films about people on the internet.
Right. Yeah. Well, and Exit Through the Gift Shop is very similar. Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's not at all invalidated by questions of veracity. It doesn't matter if it's telling you the literal truth or not in terms of, this is the sequence of events, because all of the questions that it poses are the same regardless of whether or not the film is quote unquote true.
And again, and I mean, we have this idea of documentary as objective truth. Documentary is never objective truth.
Yeah.
It's always from a point of view. So this notion that if it didn't show me something exactly as it happened and as we could all agree on this truth, then it's therefore invalidated, which is ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, do you have favorites?
Oh, gosh. I'm still trying to get through a bunch of stuff I haven't seen. I did recently see Animal Kingdom this past week. In fact, I saw The Fighter, went home, and watched Animal Kingdom.
Yeah.
And it's like, I've lost all faith in family. I don't believe in families anymore.
You call your mom and say, Mom, I love you.
I'm like, Mom, don't kill me. No, I'm still sort of forming opinions. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are films that I've seen second time, like on a second viewing, mm-hmm. That have held up really well. I saw Black Swan a second time mm-hmm. this past weekend. Loved it still. My brother came into town a few weeks ago, and he had never seen How to Train Your Dragon. Mm-hmm. And I have Blu-ray of that, so I watched it with him. I still think that film is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I like it. I think I might be in the minority of people that think it's better than Toy Story 3.
No, I think it's better than Toy Story 3. Yeah.
So, you know, I like that. And then you have the usual suspects mm-hmm. that are hitting all the critics' list. The Social Network, The King's Speech, mm-hmm. I really enjoyed. So I don't know how it's going to be ordered or mm-hmm. what's going to make the list or not. But I'm glad I'm at least finally getting to see these films. It was mm-hmm. – we suffered through a long dry stretch in the middle of the year. And, I mean, it's all coming now at the end, but I'm glad to be seeing them.
Yeah. I got to say that two films that made the top 10 list that I made – last week that probably wouldn't have made it if, you know, I was kind of looking for other things. It's like, mm-hmm. well, I guess I'll put these. Where Toy Story 3, which is a great movie, but, you know, I don't think it's that as new a movie I would want for one to be on my list. Mm-hmm. And Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which is has brilliance in it, but it's also a film that like, I'm not completely satisfied with. I think it has problems of its own, even though I think it's like an ingenious movie in a lot of ways. So I ended up, like, as the year as a whole, it's been like, well, you know, some great things and some that, you know, I thought were just okay. You know, The Fighter was in my top five. Please Give, the mm-hmm. Nicole.
See, that's a movie I still need to see. Yeah. But Nicole Holofcener.
Comedy about sort of self-obsessed New Yorkers and bleeding heart liberals in New York without hitting these kind of heavy-handed stereotypes about them. Wonderfully acted, very full of insight and wit and charm. Inception was on my top 10, you know, mm-hmm. for the kind of the coolness and the architecture of it and stuff like that.
Yeah, there have been like a lot of films I've seen on top 10s and critics mm-hmm. lists and award, you know, getting nominated for awards that I really respect, but, you know, didn't really move me in a way mm-hmm. that would sort of like, this is one of the greatest I've seen all year. Like Winter's Bone and mm-hmm. The Kids Are All Right. I think both are great films. You know, they're definitely worth checking out. But for me personally, they don't have that extra factor that sort of pushes them in. But I don't begrudge other people putting them on their list.
Well, we were talking about this last night. I mean, there are a lot of – this year for me, there are a lot of movies that are – good movies that are very much uplifted by great performances. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't quite as moved by Black Swan, though I love Barbara Hershey and I love mm-hmm. Natalie Portman in that movie. You know, I do love Winter's Bone, but I can see, mm-hmm. you know, why other people would say, well, okay, it's a good movie and, you know, maybe it's not my favorite, but I mean, you certainly have to acknowledge Jennifer Lawrence at least.
And John Hawks.
And John Hawks. And, you know, there, I think just a lot of films like that, even The Social Network, where The Social Network for me is not as powerful a movie as it is for other people, but mm-hmm. Jesse Eisenberg is magnificent mm-hmm. and he's wonderful to watch in it. So that's been sort of the tone of the year overall, is a lot of these movies are, you know, or like Get Low, which mm-hmm. I think Get Low is turning into a weird kind of dark horse for me mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. it's, you know, those two core or really three core performances I really responded to, but I really liked the movie overall. Mm-hmm. And then I guess the other thing that for me is standing as a great film is Enter the Void, is Gaspar Noé's mm-hmm. Enter the Void, which finally started playing Atlanta a couple of weeks ago. And just can't get over how both audacious and accomplished it is. Mm-hmm. And it's the complete opposite. It doesn't have particularly good performances. The acting is kind of – the acting is weird and sort of self-aware and kind of shaky, and the movie is long and self-indulgent. But it just, I mean, it's Avatar for adults. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's mm-hmm. this kind of, it just puts you into this world, and it does so, so amazingly. And I mean, I came out of it not having any idea of how half of it was made, mm-hmm. which is a pretty unusual thing these days.
Yes.
And it just, you know, you watch it and it's just this singular thing, and it just comes together and it's just fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of a stunning piece of work as a film. So the performances, whatever, but mm-hmm. as a film, holy crap, it's just magnificent mm-hmm. and really, really impressive. Mm-hmm. So that's way in. And I mean, that played it, you know, like We Finished This Yesterday cut played at Cannes 2009, but it's really kind of become, you know, so technically it's not a 2010 movie, mm-hmm. but I think it's really only opened everywhere mm-hmm. in 2010. So
yeah, it sounds... as everything by every standard that I would use, it sounds like a 2010 movie. So,
yeah. And it's not a movie for everybody by any means. But I think if you, you look up, watch the trailer and read some stuff about it, and if it even sounds and looks vaguely interesting to you, then I very much suggest going out and checking it because it's a beautiful, unusual, kind of almost transformative sort of thing.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, and I'm very excited to know that Exit to the Gift Shop is on Netflix streaming because I only got to see it the one time and I'm dying to see it again. So,
yeah, that's I saw it when we all saw it for the first time and then and hadn't seen it again until, two or three days ago. And yeah, it's been streaming as of like Tuesday.
Or pick up the DVD. The DVD comes with stickers. Yeah. And postcards and sunglasses. Yeah. I'm not kidding. It really does.
It sounds like a good Christmas gift
for
someone.
It's also affordable. Yeah.
And actually, you know what else is a good Christmas gift? Is I've been reading, there's a book series that started called Deep Focus, which is subtitled The Novel Approach to Film. And the whole idea is that these editors are having relatively well-known novelists pick a film and not like a necessarily something that's expected. And the first entry and then write about it, basically write a small book about it. And the first entry is Jonathan Lethem, who wrote Motherless Brooklyn, Fortress of Solitude, Chronic Cities, his most recent piece of fiction. And it's Lethem writing about John Carpenter's They Live. And it's sort of this full, sort of almost academic breakdown of They Live. And it's tremendously entertaining and really insightful and interesting. There's another one that's currently published that's about Death Wish, Charles Bronson movie. And then there are a couple of more that are going to be forthcoming over the next few months. But the They Live one is the only one I've read so far, and it's proven to be just absolutely fantastic. And I'd recommend it to anybody who's interested in either the author or the movie or just this idea of kind of playfully but very intelligently writing about a movie that is not maybe considered to be one of the best movies.
There probably aren't a lot of critical monographs about They Live.
He acknowledges that. Yes, that's right in the beginning of the book. Is his opening. He's like, I think I might be the only one to be doing this. But there was an interview I read with him, and I guess the basic instruction that was given was go off canon. And so,
see, and I love that because I don't really need another book long dissection of Casablanca or Citizen Kane.
Right.
What I would like to see is They Live.
Exactly.
Give me something new.
Yeah, totally. So it's this series is really promising, and I love this one so far. I have Death Wish. I'm going to start that hopefully tomorrow. And they're affordable and fun and great gifts for your friends.
Do y'all want to name a quick worst film of the year?
Last Airbender. That didn't take any time to think about.
It really didn't take any time. Yeah, I mean, wow, there's so many.
I would say Furry Vengeance. I'm kind of alone on critics who saw that because that hasn't been turning up in the end. The Brendan Fraser one.
Most use their common sense to avoid it.
And it's a hard one. It's a real kick where it hurts,
Yeah, I mean, there are a handful. Airbender is definitely up there. Tron is up there for me. I'm just going to end up thinking of more recent things. Faster, which I thought had a lot of potential as just a sort of B-movie thriller and was crap. Those are the ones that come to mind, although there are – there's never any shortage of terrible ones, really. Cop Out, was that this year?
Ooh, yep. Yes. Okay.
Yes, it was.
I've tried to forget about that. Probably anything I saw in January.
Yeah.
Prince of Persia was awful.
Prince of Persia was god-awful. I mean, most of the big summer stuff was
not that great.
Disappointing at best.
Yeah. And I mean, I dodged a lot of it, Like, I know I've been on a lot of worst lists. I've been seeing, like, Sex and the City 2.
Which I didn't see.
None of us saw it. Shockingly, none of us saw it.
Yes. Right. It was weird. How did we miss that one?
So, anyway.
By using common sense.
Yeah. Well, I guess, when we come back in January, we'll probably have lots of fun for next year's worst list, So
I want to quickly look up. I'm curious to see now what. Let's see, Chicago Now, top 11 worst movies of 2010. Because now I want to know, what did I forget?
What did I really hate? Yeah.
Well,
what did
I
hate this year?
What did I dislike so much that I just pretended didn't happen? The Tooth Fairy. I didn't see that.
That came out this year?
Yeah.
Wow.
Furry Vengeance. Oh, Marmaduke. I didn't see Marmaduke. Last Airbender. Sex and the City. Why did somebody put The American on the on a worst of 2010 list? Go screw.
Yeah, that would be one
what
of
a load
the,
of crap.
That belongs like on a best list.
I mean, certainly a worth-watching list, you know.
For sure.
So, yeah, I feel pretty good about kind of cop-out Tron, all the ones that we mentioned. Okay. Yeah.
Like, a lot of things were just, like, disappointing this year for me, you know? It's not, like, even that it was awful, but, like, Machete. It wasn't, like, the worst movie ever, but, man, was it disappointing. Yeah. You know?
It was pretty bad. Mm-hmm. Machete was bad. Yeah. We could go on. We could just start.
We could just
gradually
like
remembering
this
all of the things that we've pushed down over the past
Let's try to end on a positive
note. I'll end on a
See the fighter. Yeah. See True Grit.
Yes.
I'll end on a positive note by thanking Alejandro Leal, our engineer, who has all year been having to listen to us talk about movies at great interminable length. And once again, I'm Kurt Holman, and I'm on Twitter at Kurt_Holman.
Hi, I'm Matt Goldberg with Collider.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/MattGoldberg, all one word.
And I'm Russ Fisher from SlashFilm.com, and I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/RussFisher.
And thanks for listening through to the end, and hopefully you'll hear us in early January.